Thanks for listening to iTruths, the teaching ministry of Fellowship Bible Church of Texarkana, Texas. I'm Richard Hornock, the senior pastor of Fellowship Bible Church, and the following is a message that I delivered during one of our Sunday morning worship services. I trust it will be beneficial to your walk with Jesus Christ. Thanks again.
You know, when I was, I was in high school, my older brother, David, pastored a church in Victor, Iowa. Victor, Iowa is about 50 miles from Cedar Rapids, about 30 miles from Iowa City, out in the middle of the cornfield. David, by the way, he's the brother that did the first part of Grace's wedding. If you were at our daughter Grace's wedding back in the fall, David did the first part and asked who gives this woman that whole section. Well, the first church that David pastored was in that little town. And, it was Mayberry. It was just this wonderful, sweet little town. And this is in the late 70s. And, you know, in that community, you know, what the merchants would do is they just, you know, have accounts. You'd go to the grocery store. If you forgot your checkbook, you didn't have any cash, you'd just say, oh, just put it on my account, or, you know, and you'd go by and settle up later, you know. And some people were just into writing a monthly check to the grocery store or a monthly check to the fill-in station. That's what they actually called it, just like in Andy Griffith. And so, you know, that's how people managed. Well, we went there when I was in high school, my parents and I, and David and I went golfing with a guy named Harlan. And Harlan was this older gentleman whose son had actually graduated from seminary with David. And Harlan went and pastored a church over in Washington State. And so Harlan kind of had a special place in his heart for young pastors, because he was the father of a young pastor. Harlan was a retired farmer, and none of his sons had taken over the farm, so he'd sold out, and so he was kind of in a retirement status, and got to play a lot of golf, and he'd make sure the pastor got to play a lot of golf. And so David spent a lot of time with Harlan, and Harlan kind of became a mentor. And so when we were there for those couple days, I got to go golfing with David and Harlan. Interesting story David told me about Harlan. The previous pastor of that little church, who lived in that little town where, you know, if you didn't have money, you'd just say, oh, put it on my account, put it on my account, put it on my account. When the previous pastor left, nobody knew about it, but it came out that the previous pastor owed the fill-in station some money. And then lo and behold, they found out he owed the grocery store some money. And he owed this person some money. And he owed that person money. And, you know, in those days, everyone had a tab. And you just put it on your tab. And every once in a while, you'd go by and you'd write a check for $50 to the filling station. Or $100 to the grocery store or whatever. And this guy, whether he did it intentionally or not, when this guy moved on to the next big ministry, he left town owing a lot of people some money. Well, you know, in those days, we all got to live together. Nobody moves around the country. And so you kind of keep your offenses to yourself and just grin and bear it. And in time, they found out that the church had this major black eye because of this previous pastor. Whether he did it inadvertently or whether he just was a shyster, nobody really knew. But what was fascinating is Harlan was the first one to find out about it. And Harlan, just being the godly man that he did, and God had given him the financial means, he went to the filling station and said, hey, listen, let me just take care of that. I am so sorry, you know. And he took care of it. And he went to the grocery store and he took care of it. And then he started thinking through, where else would that guy have done business? Oh, yeah, the mechanic. And sure enough, he found out that the guy owed the mechanic some money. And he owed this guy some money. And I don't know how many hundreds of dollars, it might have been in the thousands of dollars, that Harlan put out to cover this old pastor. Not that he was bailing the old pastor out, but really what he was doing was he was just really working to protect the testimony of that local church. You know, I don't know exactly how Harlan felt, because I never had that kind of conversation with him. David just told me about him, and I, you know, from then on, I had just this incredible admiration for Harlan. But I tell you all that because I think in a way, that's kind of how Abraham is going to feel in this story we're going to look at. Now, if you haven't been around for the last couple of weeks, we're walking through the life of Abraham. Abraham is arguably the most significant man, or at least one of the most significant men to have ever lived. Today, whether they realize it or not, 5 billion people, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews, all look to Abraham as the fountainhead of their spirituality. He's the guy that 4,000 years ago, God tapped on his shoulders and said, "Hey, through you, I'm going to bless all mankind." The Muslims believe that. The Christians believe that. The Jews believe that. Of course, we all have different interpretations of just exactly how that pans out. But that's this guy, Abraham. That's why he's called the father of faith. So we've been spending some time walking through his life, and today is like the fourth installment in that. Now, what we saw last week is that Abraham and Lot was his nephew. I mean, God had blessed them, and they were incredibly rich. And they had too much to be able to abide together. And so Abraham said, "Hey, you go to the right, I'll go to the left. You go to the left, I'll go to the right." And remember the story, it's there in Genesis 13. Instead of going to the right or the left, Lot looked out straight ahead and said, "I think I'll go down there." And what was down there in the valley? The city of Sodom, the city of Gomorrah, city of several other cities. And so even though it was a stupid, foolish decision, Lot, it says, chose for himself and moved towards Sodom. Just so they knew for sure, the verse even says, "Now the people of Sodom were wicked, exceedingly wicked." Remember that verse in chapter 13? Well, what happens? You get to chapter 14, and all of a sudden you start reading about this dispute that happened, and it's kind of easy to get really lost in the weeds on this thing. So let me just kind of summarize it for you. Okay, now look at the map here. That box, that's the area of the world that we're kind of focusing in on. So you zoom in on it and you find out that there were 4 kings over there in what is now modern day Iraq who had put into submission 5 kings over in what is now the modern day area of Israel. And these 5 kings in Israel, they were basically city states. I mean, there was the city of Sodom and they had their own king. There was the city of Gomorrah and they had their own king. City state type kings. And these 4 kings way over, you know, 1,000 miles away, somehow had forced these 5 kings to start sending them taxes. Maybe they had invaded years ago and, you know, they were going to take them as slaves and they cut a deal and said, "No, you just start sending us taxes. Send us tribute." And for 12 years, those 5 kings had decided that the best thing they could do was to send the money to the 4 kings. Well, in the 13th year, they said, "Enough is enough. I'm sick of sending my money 1,000 miles away." And so the 5 kings got together and rebelled and said, "We're not doing anything." Well, guess what happened in the 14th year? The 4 kings decided to go invade the land and get their money. And, you know, before we said, okay, you just send us the money, this time they said, enough. And they went through and they captured all kinds of people, conscripted them, going to have tons of slaves, and they're taking them back. That's what happens in the first 11 or 12 verses of chapter 14. Now look at verse 12. Actually, verse 11 says, Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all the food supply, and they departed. And they also took Lot, Abraham's nephew, and his possessions, and departed. For he was now living in Sodom. Let me just talk about that. I mean, in chapter 13, Lot had pitched his tent towards Sodom. By the time you get to chapter 14, Lot is actually now living in Sodom. The compromise is just getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And so when these four kings from the east come and invade the land to take these five kings, they gather up all the able-bodied men, women, and children, and we're just going to take them back and make them slaves. These people won't behave, staying 1,000 miles away. We're just going to take them home with us. We'll leave the old people. They left the kings. I mean, because usually kings probably were older men, and they thought, we can't get much manual labor out of them anyway. We'll leave them here. But the young people, the able-bodied people, we're taking them. So they invade the land. They gather up all the able-bodied people, plus all the good possessions, and they're heading back home. Now look at verse 13. Then a fugitive came and told Abram, the Hebrew. By the way, isn't it interesting? This is the first time Abraham is ever called a Hebrew. What does the word Hebrew mean? It means one from over there. He wasn't one of us. Who was the us in the land? The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, etc. The foreigner. That's what Hebrew means. His roots, remember, were way back in Ur. He had family in Haran, Paddan Aram. Remember when it comes time for Abraham to figure out who Isaac, his son's going to marry? I don't want him marrying any of these pagan girls around here. You go back home and find him one. We are Hebrews. We're not from here. We're from over there. That's what the word Hebrew means. This world is not our home. This place isn't our home. That's our home. Abraham the Hebrew, the fugitive, comes and tells him, hey, they have come through and they've taken everything. Now look at it, verse 13. Now he at that time was living in the oaks of Mamre, and the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and the brother of Aner, and these were all allies with him. He'd kind of formed some relationships, some coalitions with them. And when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men. Boy, we could talk about that trained men. His discipled men, men that he had poured his life into and gotten them on board with this mission that God had called him to. He led out his trained men, those guys born in his house, 318 of them, by the way. And they went in pursuit as far as Dan. Remember, Dan is up there at the top of the nation. I mean, these people have already hightailed it out. They're on their way back over to Iraq with our people. And so what does Abraham do? He divides his forces. They catch up with them. They go in and they defeat them. And they're doing this all the way on the north side of Damascus. And now they're nearly 100 miles down the road. And he brought back, verse 16, he brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot and his possessions and all the women and all the people. You know what? This essentially was one of those tests that Abraham went through. You know, Abraham's life, it's just basically a series of faith tests. How are you going to respond, Abraham? Are you going to lie about the identity of your wife? Or are you going to tell the truth? How are you going to respond, Abraham? I mean, there's no food here. Are you going to flee to Egypt? Or are you going to stay here and see how God provides? How are you going to respond, Abraham? I mean, there's not enough stuff for you and Lot to stay together. How are you going to handle this skirmish with your relative? Well, here's just another test. What are you going to do, Abraham? God has given you this land. God said, walk around in it. It's yours. I'm giving you this land. And now, four kings from back home have invaded, and they've taken all these people. And guess what? One of them is your relative. Your family has been violated. That's a test. I mean, so here's the question Abraham had to ask. Am I going to act on these promises? Am I going to live as if it's really true? That was the first test Abraham had to face. And, you know, if you sit and think about it, you got four kings that were able to subdue five kings from 1,000 miles away and take them all the way back. And Abraham, with the guys in his household, his own employees, so to say, and some alliances that he gathered, he was able to go defeat them. That's pretty miraculous. I mean, that's an incredible victory that we just skipped through there. But the biggest thing was Abraham said, this is my land. That's my relative. Yeah, he's a jerk. Yeah, he left town owing a whole bunch of money at the filling station. And I got to go clean up his mess. But Abraham did it. Not because he loved Lot so much, but because he trusted God and he came and protected the land. That's test number one. Now, that's a big test, okay? And it was a big victory. But you know what? That wasn't the biggest test that Abraham faced that day. Look at verse 17, okay? Here's where we're going to slow down. We're going to start looking at the text a little deeper. They're coming back down through the land, coming right down the middle of it, on that western side of the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River and the Dead Sea, coming right down through it, and they get to an area where modern-day Jerusalem is. And, I mean, they're heroes. I mean, they've just, you know, that was a pretty big deal. Five cities were just ransacked and taken off. And Abraham, this guy that isn't even from here, he's a Hebrew, he's from over there. He goes and rescues them, brings them back. And they are, there's kind of this entourage coming back down through the land. And they get outside of modern-day Jerusalem. At that time, it was called Salem, Jerusalem. At that time, it was just Salem. And look what happened. Verse 17. Then after the return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the Valley of Sheba. That is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, he also comes out. Let's just stop there. So here's what happens. Abraham, as he's coming back, is met by two kings. The king of Sodom and the king of Salem. Let's talk about this king of Salem first, and then we'll go back and talk about the king of Sodom. This is the second test, okay? The first test was, you believe God gave you this land? You believe God's going to take care of your family? You know, pick up your sword and go prove it. That was the first test. Here's the second test. And like I said, this is much bigger, but it is far more subtle. And I would say that these are the kinds of tests that you and I face a lot more often. I mean, I haven't seen anyone come and try to take my lawn. You know, I haven't seen anyone come and try to take my house. You know, kind of wish someone would come and steal some of my kids. But, you know, just pay for them. That's all I'm asking. But no, you know, I mean, nobody's done that to me. I haven't faced that kind of test. I seriously doubt you have. People in other parts of the world do face those things. This next test, this is the kind we face. Here's Abraham. He's got the king of Sodom and the king of Salem. Now, this king of Salem, this is interesting. His name is Melchizedek, and he's the king of Salem. What does Salem mean, by the way? Peace. Shalom. Peace. He is the king of peace, but his name is Melchizedek. Do you know what Melchizedek means? It means king of righteousness. So here's the king of peace, who is the king of righteousness, who comes out to meet Abraham after this incredible victory. And I mean, there's got to be 1,000 people or more with Abraham. I mean, good grief, if he took 318 of his own people, who knows how many the other people brought. Plus, he's got all these POWs that he's just rescued, one of which is Lot and his wife and kids. And so this is a huge entourage. And I don't know whether Abraham was leading the entourage as they came home. But here comes two kings to meet him. King of Salem, the king of Sodom. And the king of Salem is some guy that Abraham's never met. I mean, he's been living in the land now for 7, 8, 9 years. And he's a pretty big dude. But I've never met the king of Salem. Met the king of these other kings. But I've never met the king of Salem. The king of peace, whose name happens to mean king of righteousness. And Melchizedek comes out, and Abraham, I'm sure, is feeling pretty good about himself. I mean, my goodness, he just kicked tail on these guys from the east. And here comes Melchizedek, and immediately Abraham realizes this guy might be from here, but he is not part of here. He's not a pagan. He's not a Canaanite, a Jebusite, a Hittite, or a Perizzite, or whatever. This guy is different because this guy, look at it, is a priest of El Elyon, the Most High God. And all of a sudden, Abraham realizes that this guy is his spiritual superior. This guy is functioning as a priest. What's a priest? A priest is someone that represents people to God. But he's also functioning as a prophet. What's a prophet? A prophet is someone that represents God to people. And so this priest of the Most High God, this priest of El Elyon, he says in verse 19, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High. Blessed be Abram of El Elyon." Who's El Elyon? He is the possessor of heaven and earth. And Melchizedek blessed him. And it says, "And blessed be El Elyon, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." This victory did not come because your 318 guys were so well trained. This victory didn't come because you had this lightning bolt strategy of, you know, hey, we're going to attack them at night and circle around and get them in the backside and all this good stuff that they actually did. This victory came because God gave it. And all this stuff that you got here, it belongs to El Elyon. And it's like Melchizedek came out there representing God and wanting to represent Abraham to God. And he said, all this stuff, it's God's. This great victory, it came from God. And notice what it says, verse 20. "And Abram gave him a tenth of all." He sacrificed. a tenth of his possessions to God, gave it to this priest. You know, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, you know, this Melchizedek is kind of this cryptic guy, and I'll talk about him here in a little bit more. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, Abraham at that time was not the only follower of the one true God. He just happens to be the guy that God tapped on his shoulder and said, through you, I'm going to bless all mankind. But he had other followers. I mean, we're pretty certain that Job was a contemporary of Abraham. We don't exactly know exactly where Job was living, but Job seems to be someone who was living around the same time as Abraham. He's not a descendant of Abraham. He's not in that family tree. He's just a parallel guy. You know, the vast majority of the world had gone astray from God, but God still had some true believers, some people who still knew who he was. Job was one of them. Abraham became one of them. And Abraham is the one that God said, I'm going to bless all mankind through you. You're going to be the conduit. Job could have been, but Job's not it. You know, this other guy over here could have been, but he's not it. Abraham, you are it. Another one of those guys is this guy named Melchizedek. And evidently Melchizedek is a guy that he's Christ-like. He's a king. Christ is a king. He's a priest because he represents godly people to God. And he's a prophet. He speaks for God. He's a prophet, priest, and king, just like Christ. I mean, many people think this is Christ. This is a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. That could be. At a bare minimum, he is a Christ figure. And Abraham is smart enough, with it enough, to realize, you know what? This guy is a guy that can lead me to the Lord. This is a guy that I can learn from. This is a guy that I need to invest in. And what does he do? He gives him a tenth. You know, we always think of this tenth, tithing. That's something that Moses started. This is 600 years before Moses was even born. I mean, the standard, one of the characteristics of a person who really knows God is that they give. And they give sacrificially, and they're giving a tenth. They're giving even more than that sometimes. But a tenth is it. That's been God's standard. And it's interesting, when you trace that all throughout Scripture, the godly response to worship is sacrificing, giving a tenth. You know, I don't want to hit this, you know, beat this too much, but just think about it. That is what God expects of us. If we are God's people, if we're God's worshipers, we should be giving a tenth, at least. That's what Abraham did in this response. It's just illustrated for us here. You know, I mean, if we as God's people, if we all would give a tenth, I mean, the church, not just Fellowship Bible Church, but the church wouldn't have any issues financially. The big issues would be, are we spending this wisely? I mean, we wouldn't owe Capital One money. We wouldn't have a mortgage because we would have been able to pay it off. The church wouldn't owe me money. It wouldn't owe the Tuttlebys money. I mean, we'd be able to pay our bills. We'd be able to sit and say, man, we got to find some more missionaries so we can invest in the kingdom. We can give more. I mean, you know, Texarkana's got tons of homeless people. I wonder how we could help them. You know, there's tons of kids that are getting pregnant out of wedlock. And so how can we help First Choice? I mean, if we all gave the way we're supposed to, as illustrated right here, God's kingdom would not lack for money. And so here is literally the one guy on the face of the earth who God has said, through you, I'm going to bless all mankind. This guy comes and he has an encounter with Christ. And he says, I have got to worship. And one of the ways he worshiped was by giving. If that's not a part of our life, we really cannot fully say we're worshiping like we should. I mean, we can say we're worshiping, but we're not, to be honest. So Abraham comes out, he meets the king of Salem, and I mean, he ends up on his knees. And, you know, just one more detail about it, of him being so Christ-like. I'm not sure any of the readers really got it, but did you notice he brings out bread and wine? I mean, is that like a prototype of something that's going to happen 2,000 years later when Jesus is going to use bread and wine to commemorate his death and resurrection and the forgiveness of sin in it, the substitutionary atonement? So the first king he meets is Melchizedek, the king of peace, the king of righteousness, who is a representative of God, who says, Abraham, it's all God's. And all of this great victory that you just got came from God. He is the possessor of heaven and earth. But look at verse 21. There's another king that comes out. The king of Sodom, verse 21, said to Abraham, okay, just give me the people and you can take the possessions for yourself. You can keep the goods. I just want the people. Well, fortunately, Abraham had already had his conversation with Salem. I hope he would have said the same thing if Sodom had spoke first, but maybe God wasn't going to give him the chance. He just wanted to make sure he knew he had met Melchizedek first. What does Abraham do? Verse 22. Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High. I've sworn to El Elyon. I've sworn to El Elyon. It's like Abraham learned a new name for God that day. I thought his name was Elohim. You know, the Israelites, who were the first ones to read this, they thought his name was Yahweh or Jehovah. And here we learn a new name for him. He's El Elyon. He's the Most High God. And he said, I have sworn by the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I am not going to take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you say, I made Abraham rich. Mr. Sodom, I'm not giving you anything. I'm not taking anything from you because I know what you'll do with it. But I mean, think about the temptation, okay? Abraham, I mean, he's just got the goods from five cities that have been captured. And the guy says, just let the people go. And you keep everything and we'll call it even. I mean, we thought Abraham was rich before. I mean, he'd have been richer than five kings combined. And he says, no. Look at verse 24. Here's what I'm going to do. I will take nothing except what the young men have already eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Those partners, they can have theirs. They can speak for themselves. I may have led the coalition, but they were independent contractors and they joined in. So they might take it, but I'm not taking it. You know, Warren Wiersbe, when he talks about this, Warren Wiersbe's a pastor that writes a lot of good commentaries on the Bible. He says, it's interesting. Sodom said, keep the possessions, give me the people. And Abraham says, no, you can have the possessions. And maybe what Abraham said is, let's let the people do what they want. I'll keep the people. Except he didn't force the people to stay with him. It's like, let's give them a choice. So here's Abraham. And he says, I'm not taking any of it. But we're going to let the people do what they want. Now think about it. Started off talking about Lot. And how Lot had, through a series of compromises, not just pitched his tent towards Sodom, He ended up living in Sodom. And now this guy, Lot, Abraham's nephew, who had a front row seat on seeing how God is working through Abraham, and I think probably had a front row seat when he saw Melchizedek. Who's this Melchizedek? He comes out, and Abraham all of a sudden is saying, "Yes, sir. You tell me about the Most High God." Lot saw it all. And yet, what did Lot do? Lot went back to Sodom. It's incredible. See, because if you don't know the story, in about four chapters, we're going to find Lot now not just living in Sodom, he's going to be a leader of Sodom. He is going to be compromising more and more and more and more until finally he's going to be on the city council of Sodom. Sodom! I mean, even in the day when this was written, Sodom was synonymous with wickedness. When you say Sodom, everybody knows what you're referring to. It is a wicked place. And Lot is given this opportunity to get out of there. Whew. Man, thank you, Uncle Abe. He goes back to Sodom. You know, I talked about how this thing is full of tests. There was the test for Abraham. Do I believe these promises enough to go get Lot again and rescue him, protect this land? There was the test for Abraham. Who am I going to honor? Salem or Sodom? Do I believe this king of Salem, this king of righteousness who says God is the possessor of all and everything belongs to him? What's the old saying? A bird in the hand is better than two in the bush. Sodom is offering me all of this stuff. That was a test. And Abraham turns it off. Walks away from it. Abraham's in this test, and it's like, which king am I going to honor? Which king am I going to trust to provide? But you know what? Abraham wasn't the only person who was tested that day, was he? Lot was tested. Those other people were tested. Am I going to follow the king of Sodom back to Sodom, or am I going to go with this guy that rescued me and the king of righteousness? The king of peace. Well, we know what Lot did. He went back to Sodom. We know what probably a lot of those people did. They went back to Sodom. They went back to Sodom. They went back to Gomorrah. They went to Zoar. They went to all these other places. They just resumed their lifestyle. It's like God had given them this great exit out of the temptation, and they went right back. Now, let me just kind of tie all this together. I love the way Erwin Lutzer puts it. Every one of us stands between two kings. King Jesus and some other king. We don't think that life is that black and white, but in reality it is. Whether you're a child of God or not, even us children of God stand between two kings, King Jesus and some other king, Salem and Sodom, Melchizedek or Bera. Who are you going to follow? Who are you going to trust? Here's this one that is offering the world, and here's the other one that is just promising me heaven. Who are you going to follow? You know, it's kind of interesting. We always say, you know, that we make decisions and we should make decisions with our heart. Or excuse me, that we should make decisions with our head. And we should. But the truth of the matter is, every one of us, it is very difficult to make decisions with our head. Because really what we do is we follow with our hearts. You know, every month I get our credit card bill and I categorize it so I can figure out how to, you know, pay for it from this checkbook, this checkbook, or this savings account and all that stuff. And so, okay, I just this last week paid for Christmas. And, you know, as I'm sorting through all these things and I'm going now, what was that? What was that? What was that? Everything got categorized into the Christmas column on my little spreadsheet. And, you know, I was just amazed at, it's like, wow, we spent a lot. And it wasn't that I spent a bunch on Vicky and she spent a bunch on me. We spent a bunch on our kids. You say, we got a lot of kids. Yeah, but, I mean, we spent a lot on our kids individually and on our grandchildren. Well, why did we do that? Well, I'm sure that some of it is, you know, some compulsion that goes back 30 years ago. And we'll blame it on our parents. But you know why we did it? Because that's who we love. And I'm willing to sacrifice for my kids. And I'm willing to sacrifice for my grandkids. And you know what? You are too. If you got kids, you sacrifice for them. You may have more control and say, okay, we're going to keep it to $72, you know, nothing more. But you do other things for them. You give them more time. You give them more this. You give them more that. Every one of us, you know what? The truth of the matter is we sacrifice for the things we love, for the people we love. I mean, you want to know who I love? Look at how I spend my money. Look at how I spend my time. Look at how I spend my emotions. Look at how I spend my energy. You want to know who you love? Just do the same with you. Look at your wallet. Look at your checkbook. Look at your schedule. You'll see who you love, what you love. I mean, I honestly think, you know, we can sit and say all day, we got to make decisions with our head, and we should. Because a lot of times our heart's not where it should be. But you know what? It is so much easier if our heart is where it should be. Where should our heart be as children of God? I love what Paul said in Colossians 3:2. Set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth. What do you love? Honestly, what do you love? I think in this story, we saw that Abraham, when he met the King of Righteousness, who was the King of Peace, who came out and represented him to God and spoke to him from God. I mean, I think Abraham was like, I'm ruined. I am all in for El Elyon. And that's why he went there. Lot, not so much. Not at all. Lot's affections were not rooted in El Elyon. They were rooted in something else. Where are your affections? Where are my affections? Set your affections on things above. Yeah, Lot, make the decision with your head. Well, rarely can our heads disagree with our hearts. I know they need to. Mine needs to all the times, because there's a lot of times my heart is saying to do something that is totally contrary to God's will. But you know what it is also saying? Richard, get your heart in order. And you know what? That's what God's saying to you. Get your heart in order. I mean, I don't know where Abraham's heart was when he met Melchizedek, but I know where it was when he left Melchizedek. Unfortunately, we also know where Lot's heart was when he left Melchizedek. And he followed his heart all the way back to Sodom. Look at this next verse. This is from the Apostle John. do not love the world or the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, I love the way the King James put it, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, it's not from the Father, but it is from the world. Don't you realize the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. Don't love the world. Do you love the world? Let me just tell you, if you do, you're going to continually follow your heart to Sodom. I mean, that is why we have these yo-yo relationships with God. In God's will, out of God's will. Choosing for God, choosing against God. I mean, it is because our heart is trying to stand and please both kings. I mean, we have got to turn our back on the king of Sodom and fully embrace King Jesus. That's what Abraham did here. But Lot did not do that. You know, how do I know where my heart is? Well, we knew where Abraham's heart was. Man, when he came face to face with who God is and who this Melchizedek was and this he's El Elyon, he was willing to sacrifice. He gave. I mean, look at who you give to. Look at how you invest your time, your money, your energy, your emotions. Love not the world. Love the Lord, your God, with all your heart, soul, and mind. That's what Jesus said. See, this is a powerful, powerful illustration for us because Abraham models for us the way we're supposed to be. There was this humility and this commitment and this tenacity and this generosity. Lot didn't have it. Lot didn't have it. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. Love of the Father, it's not in you when that's there. You know, you probably got to be my age or older to know who this guy is. But do you remember who George Beverly Shea was? Okay, George Beverly Shea was the guy that got up and sang right before Billy Graham preached to 30,000 people. Okay? And guy had an incredible voice. I remember 30 years ago when Billy Graham was up in Little Rock, Vicki and I were picking my parents up from the airport, and so we went to the Billy Graham Crusade that night at War Memorial, and we heard Bill Clinton give his testimony, and we heard Billy Graham preach. We also heard George Beverly Shea sing right before Billy preached. I mean, well known. I'm sure he died 20 years ago or so. George Beverly Shea was good. Okay, a lot of times we think Christians, well, they made it in the Christian industry, but, you know, they couldn't have made it out in the big time. George Beverly Shea was good. He was really good. And he had a contract offer from RCA that was as big as big gets in that industry. This is back in the 30s and the 40s. And interestingly, after he had met with the people and had this incredible offer from RCA to become one of their people, you know, who knows, maybe he could have become the next Frank Sinatra or some other guy from that era. He went back to his practice studio. And he's a believer. Strong believer. In fact, he was working for Moody Bible Institute at the time up in the ninth floor, you know, recording music and singing on their radio station and all that stuff. He goes back to his practice studio, and there on the piano was the music to a song that he had been working on. It was a new song. And quite frankly, the only reason he was learning it was because his mother said, boy, I wish you'd learn that song. And, you know, we all do what our moms ask us to do occasionally. And so George Beverly Shea was going to do what his mom asked him to do, and he was going to learn that song. You know what the song, the words to the song were? I'd rather have Jesus than silver than gold, silver and gold. I'd rather have Jesus than riches untold. I'd rather have Jesus than to be the king of a vast domain. I'd rather have Jesus than anything. Remember that song? And you know what? He wrote RCA a note and said, thanks but no thanks. I mean, you and I, that's what God has called us to. I mean, we stand every day and every moment of every day between the king of righteousness and the king of Sodom. And the king of Sodom is offering us an incredible deal. But the king of righteousness is also the one who represents El Elyon. Let's pray. Father, I pray that today you would help us to truly be wise, Father, and follow you closely. Father, I pray for our hearts. I know our heads need to be right, but Father, there's so many times we ignore our heads and we just go with our heart. Father, I pray that today we would work on our hearts. We would set our affections on things above. We would not love the world. I pray, Father, that in a very real way, there would be an incredible desire in us to acknowledge you as El Elyon, the Most High God. For it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.